Hello and welcome to The Big Interview. I'm Steve Bloomfield. My guest today is Lise Doucette, one of the most recognisable faces and voices on the BBC. For more than three decades, she's been reporting from around the world, focusing mainly on the Middle East. Her reports from Afghanistan and Syria in particular have helped to shape the way we view those countries. Her stories are never two-dimensional, never just about who is fighting whom. They're empathetic. They tell us about the lives of ordinary people caught up in extraordinary and often harrowing situations. At a time when the conflict in Syria is entering its seventh year with no end in sight, and when the West appears to have lost interest in Afghanistan, Lise Doucette's reporting is more important than ever. Lise Doucette, welcome to The Big Interview.
It's so lovely to be here with you.
Thank you very much for coming. Let us start with a big question for The Big Interview. Why did you want to become a journalist?
I still think, after more than 30 years of being a journalist, including some years when I was pretending or trying to be a journalist, that it is still the most privileged job in the world. And for me, it is like being at school for all of your life. It's one continuing education. And to this day, it both amazes and delights me that I can go almost anywhere in the world and knock on a door and say, hello, I'm Lise Doucette of the BBC. Can I come in and talk to you? And they agree. And if they don't agree, then that's a story too. It's such a privilege, but of course, a responsibility as well, because people tell you their stories in sometimes what are the best of times and the worst, or the worst of times, and sometimes both of them mixed up. And so you have a responsibility to convey that story correctly and faithfully.
And can you remember the moment when you decided this is what I want to do? What was there a moment?
I remember I grew up in a very small town on the east coast of Canada. And I remember thinking, well, first of all, I come from a Catholic family. So first of all, for many years, I wondered whether I would be a nun. And the father of my best friend would tell us, when you grow up, you're going to be a nun or a nun. Either N-U-N or N-O-N-E. So, of course, for many years, you pray at the side of your bed to whether or not this is going to be. Then at a certain point, I thought it would be good to be a lawyer. But then another friend's father was a lawyer, but he was an alcoholic. And at some point, it must have been in my high school, because I still have a late book slip from the Nipisiquit General Library entitled How to Be a Journalist. Now, I don't know if I ever gave the book back, but I certainly kept it too long. And I think that was it, that I decided that I would be a journalist. I didn't study journalism. I studied politics first and economics and international relations. And then I went out in the big world to try to become a journalist.
And you say now it's a privilege and an education. But at the time, what was your drive at the time when you thought, when you held on to that library book?
Curiosity. Just if you grew up in a small town and in your history and geography classes, I still remember studying the Phoenicians doing the boats that they had. I still remember, in fact, for a long time, I forgot. And I only discovered one time when I went home that when I was younger, I used to collect dolls of the world. So dolls from, and in fact, it was interesting to go home and find out that I had dolls from countries I ended up going to. Complete coincidence, I must say. This is not, I'm not trying, your listeners are going to think, my God, she's a wacko.
That's not what led you to certain countries.
And they're not voodoo dolls. But it's really curiosity. At university, I was one of those people, I'll read one more book, I'll do this one more, I'll talk to one more person. And of course, your deadlines are so sometimes quite fluid that you can just keep going and going. And I have to say that when
That's
I graduated...
That's not good training for journalism.
When I graduated from my first degree, at the end toward, before graduation, the head of the department said, how many courses is Lise taking? She's not going to finish all of them. Like, everything was so interesting to me. But for me, journalism is a much better way, because if your program goes out at 12 o'clock today, you can't be out at 1 o'clock. So it's always a new story, a new... Of course, sometimes you do longer one-hour programs, as you know, or long interviews like this. But there's a deadline, and you do what you can as best as you can, and then it's gone, and you do another one. And for me, it works better as a structure.
And did you know from early on that the stories you wanted to tell, the things you wanted to learn about yourself, were outside of Canada?
I think I at university, my second degree at University of Toronto was in international relations, and I studied a lot about Africa. And for some reason, how does one make these choices? African agriculture. What do I know about African agriculture? I still think these days, poor guys from Tanzania must have thought, who's this bird, you know, talking about African agriculture? She's never been to Africa, you know, hardly ever in a field, although we did grow up close on farms. And so I joined Canadian Crossroads International, which was a volunteer organization. And first of all, I was going to be sent to Ethiopia, and then the Ethiopians didn't like someone who was expressing an interest in journalism. Then it was going to be India, but I wasn't quite finished my master's degree, of course. And then Ivory Coast came up, Côte d'Ivoire. They figured Lise Doucette, she must speak French. So I went there and I worked for 4 months and then started out freelancing. And it was one of those classic, although I'm told women aren't supposed to say this, they're supposed to say, and of course I was so experienced, so intelligent, so clever, but I will say, right place, right time. The BBC was setting up its first West Africa office, and there I was, wrong accent, wrong CV. My only journalism experience was a few articles for Real Estate News in Toronto and a university paper, and wrong country, everything. But by an act of God, I got taken on, and that was in 1983. And for better or worse, I'm now part of the furniture at the BBC. But I always wanted to do foreign news. And as you know, there aren't many shortcuts. When I graduated from university, there was a recession in Canada, so there weren't many jobs for journalists. So every time I applied for a job, they'd say, well, you have to have a journalism degree, which I didn't want to have, and you have to have experience, which I didn't have. So I thought the best way to do it is to go abroad and to take a calculated risk. And it was a risk because I had no money, no experience, but it paid off. And so when I speak to young journalists, I always say, take a risk, but take a calculated risk. And right now, of course, it's difficult because a lot of places are a lot more dangerous than when I started. But I think when you begin, you have to dream big and go for what you'd like to do.
Do you think there's been a change in recent years that we talk less about foreign news and more about international news? Because the news is being, you know, even if it's being produced in the UK, it's being listened to, watched to, or read elsewhere. That it's not necessarily about explaining things to, if you work at the BBC, for a British audience anymore. It's about explaining things to the world.
Yes, for so long, international news has stopped being foreign. You know, and I say this, for example, one of the big stories of our time, Syria. Syria's war is no longer out, you know, those countries, as we would say, out there way far away. You know, Syria is down the street next door in your children's schools. It's, you know, your country is involved in Syria. The country next door is involved in Syria. Syria's war is in effect, you know, a war of the world. So many countries are involved. And yes, the BBC is a domestic broadcaster principally because it is financed in large part by the license fee. But we have the World Service in radio for decades. We have BBC World TV, which is a younger part of the BBC, but it's commercial. It's funded by advertising. So obviously the global audiences maybe know more the ins and outs of particular stories. Obviously, if you're listening in Afghanistan, you know more about Afghanistan. And if you're listening in Syria, you know more Syria, etc. When you drill down to the storytelling, it is a story that all of us recognize. It is a story about fathers and mothers and children and neighbors and societies and whole communities being ripped apart. And that is something everyone can understand. That is not something which is that British or Canadian, or it doesn't matter where we come from. We all live the same human story.
I want to talk about Syria a little more in a moment. But first, I want to talk about another country which has been, you know, a big part of your reporting career, and that's Afghanistan. Mm. You first went there in the late 1980s?
When I began as a journalist, after I started, you know, by the luck of the draw or the luck of life in 1983, I ended up staying for 5 years and traveling across the region. And by the help of a kind British diplomat, because I couldn't find any way to get to Britain, I got sponsored by the West Africa Committee of the Foreign Office, who said, for God's sake, all she wants to do is come for 6 months to Britain. But then after that, at that point, I used to literally put a finger on a map and say, where else in the world can I go? And after my six-month visa was work permit was finished, I decided to go to Pakistan, you know, and everyone in the BBC said, no, thank you, Lise. We already have many people there. And I said, well, I think I'm going to Pakistan. So I went to Quetta, which nobody was in Quetta. And that's where Hamid Karzai was, who ended up becoming the president of Afghanistan. I met so many people in 1988, who turned out to be very important people in the future of Afghanistan 2 decades later. But I applied for the BBC Pakistan job. And even though I proved to the BBC, after having them having said to me, no, Lise, no thanks, I ended up doing stories from Quetta. And they went, oh, Quetta, that's so interesting. Oh, wow, Lise is there. Oh, we'll take that story. And then I went to Peshawar. And then I was doing the elections with Benazir Bhutto. But when the time came to apply for the job, I was still too junior. And the person who got the job said, get Lise Doucette out of here. So I got a visa by, again, kindness.
They saw you as a threat.
Yes, because they wanted their wife to help them out. So kindness of strangers. The BBC hadn't been getting visas to Afghanistan for a long time. So some people helped me to get a visa. And on Christmas Eve, my birthday, 1988, I flew into Kabul. And at the desk, they said, how long are you staying? And I said, well, I'm not sure. So I said 6 weeks, and sort of, you know, 5 years later, I was still reporting for Pakistan, Afghanistan, and from Iran as well. Because what happened was the person who got the job didn't turn out very well, and a year later the job came up, and of course, who got it? But I said the condition is that I will report from Afghanistan, because Afghanistan really marked me.
Yeah,
be hard not. First of all, the country has such a compelling story, and the people have such a strong sense of self. And this wicked sense of humor, despite the very troubled history that they have lived through. And when you were reporting for the BBC then, I mean, 95% of the Afghans in refugee camps, and at them they were the Syrians of the world, they were the biggest refugee community anywhere, 95% were listening to the BBC, and my reports would be translated into Persian and into Pashto. The story of the time, and it's not apocryphal, is that in the evening, battles would stop. So that people, the fighters, both in terms of the Mujahideen backed by the West and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia, and the fighters of the Afghan army backed by the Russians, they would all stop to listen to the BBC to see who was winning. And that was how important the BBC services were. So to be reporting for the BBC from Afghanistan. So I, you know, fell in love with Afghanistan at that time. It just captured my imagination. So that when I got the BBC Pakistan job a year later, I made it a condition that I would also cover Afghanistan as well. And I'd also started going to Iran. And so that was part of it. So I then stayed till 92, 93.
What was it like? What was it that made you think this is a country that is going to mean something to me?
This is back to my point about it being a privilege. You'd almost think it was a novel. It was a cold, harsh, dark winter. It turned out to be the end of the Cold War with the Russian defeat. They would call it, you know, their departure, but the Russian defeat in Afghanistan. All of the eyes of the world were on Afghanistan, because shortly after I arrived, the British pulled down the flag and left. The Americans pulled down the flag and left. One by one, all of the embassies left because they wanted to put pressure on the Russians. There are so many parallels to what is happening now. In the same way that they say, they're not saying it as much now, but in the early years of the Syrian war, Assad must go. Not just Assad must go, but Assad will go, matter of days. That is what they were saying at the time about Soviet-backed Najibullah. And similarly with President Assad, if you talk to President Najibullah's supporters at that time, is that they were saying he's not going to go. And there was so much speculation. Of course, we had no internet then. So journalists outside were reporting one thing. Journalists inside, including myself, were reporting something. And so one by one, the journalists also started leaving because, you know, I got taken aside by UN people saying, you have to leave. The Mujahideen are coming. They're going to treat you terribly. You must leave. But I just could find nothing in myself to want to leave or to think I should leave.
Did you think it could be dangerous?
No, I didn't actually. I had this faith. I don't know, we say in journalism, you know, your gut instinct. By then I was living in the hotel. Everyone at the hotel was so kind to me. You know, in fact, one time, every day I'd order the same thing, chicken kebab. And then one day the head of the food and beverage services said, the chicken's too expensive now in the market. We're not getting any more chicken. So the head of room service threatened to resign because Lise was getting chicken every day. So they continued to get chicken because I was having chicken kebab every day because I didn't really want to have the beef. And then I went away in August, you know, I was still there and there were two journalists still there, myself and John Burns of the New York Times. And so we thought we have to go over to Pakistan because they're constantly saying to us in Kabul, we took this hill, we took this valley. So we said, right, we're going to go to the top of that hill. So we went to the top of the hill in Jalalabad, which of course is where Islamic State is based now. We went literally like marched up the hill and marched down again, went up with the Mujahideen, and then came back to Kabul. And when I came back to Kabul, I found that my room, I think it was room 444, had been taken over by the Afghan intelligence services. And the week that we were gone, the Mujahideen actually hit the hotel. And that was the only time they hit the hotel. So, and I knew the guy who was said to have hit it. So later I said to him, "Why, Abdulhaq, why did you hit the hotel?" But of course, it was rather funny, is that having gone all the way to eastern Afghanistan with the Mujahideen, walked up the hill and walked down, which was quite a trek. We went back to the Afghan army guy and said, "We walked up that hill and walked down." He goes, "No, no, we're in control of that hill. We are still." I said, "Well, it's up there. You are not in control of it." They said, "Yes, yes, we are. But, you know, it's fake news," although we didn't know the fake news. So we used to have a saying, you know, "Don't forget Afghanistan." And after the events of 9/11, where Tony Blair and George Bush stood with President Karzai and they had that phrase, "We are with you for the long run. We are standing shoulder to shoulder." And I remember thinking at the time, how long is the long run? Mm. And the long run turned out to be about a decade. I know they feel let down by the world. Not that they want the rest of the world to be there all the time, giving them money and their troops on the ground. But government's commitments to others' wars. And of course, now we see what happened in Syria. Governments are so reluctant to get involved because you spend money, you it costs lives, and you just don't know how it will turn out. And the experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq have been cautionary tales because it takes a lot longer. It takes far longer than a decade. It takes a generation, and most governments are not willing. But Afghanistan still needs the world's help. And I'm now trying to find a way to go back to Afghanistan. I've been very busy on Syria. You have to feel for countries. You have to feel for people who are in their 30s and their 40s who have only known a country at war. And when you think of what happened after the fall of the Taliban in 2001, the excitement in Afghanistan was palpable, the best chance in a generation. And it didn't work. And, you know, it has led all of us to say, what will it take when you get men and women of goodwill with a lot of resources, including troops, that try to put a country back together again?
When you say that, you know, it didn't work, what role do you think you as a journalist can or should play in helping to make it work? Because this is a country that you know very, very well. You've spent a lot of time in, that you've lived in. You know all the people in positions of power as well. Do you feel that it's your place to say what should happen, or to try to persuade people in power elsewhere what should do? Or do you feel like, I'm just here to tell a story and, you know, the politics of this is nothing to do with me?
It's always a fine line. And I work for a public broadcaster. So, you know, some media are more robust in taking a view on issues. They're expected to editorially. They're known for doing so. But in the BBC, we're not, despite criticism that we do, we're not meant to. We're meant to talk to all sides, listen to all sides. But I will answer your question by way of saying this, that after more than a decade in Afghanistan, where undeniably Afghanistan was a different country a decade after 9/11, to see a young generation which took advantage of scholarships in the West and more resources in the country, to see a government which didn't exist. I mean, in 2001, when the Taliban fell, there were hollowed out offices, there weren't chairs, there weren't computers, there weren't any telephones. People had to leave the country to make a telephone call. So by that standard, you know, and then Afghanistan had a constitution, an elected government, an elected president. So a lot changed in Afghanistan. But it didn't change as much as people on all sides expected. And so you'd end up sitting around these tables in Kabul, where you'd have leading aid people, leading military people, leading Afghans, and everyone would be saying, what lessons have we learned? And everyone would give their considered view. And these are people who worked a long time. And then at the end of the evening, they'd say, well, do you know what? The main lesson is we should have listened to Afghans. And I remember at one dinner and I said, that's it? That is it? You should have listened to Afghans? And it is at once so simple and yet so hard, because the tendency is that people will come in and we're in a hurry. We want to spend the money. We want to make a difference. And even when you think it's genuine, that you say, okay, wait, I'll do it. I'll show you how to do it later. I'll do it first. Or this is the way we should do it. And often we didn't listen to the Afghans. And in some ways, perhaps Afghans didn't know how to tell us how they wanted to do it. Mistakes were made on all sides. So the role of a journalist, I think that is part of our profession, is to listen. Listen to Afghans, listen to Syrians, listen to Canadians, listen to Brits. Our job is to ask questions and to listen to the answers. So I think we just have to keep asking questions. And I find the responses that I often get, which are the ones which stay with me, is when people hear very articulate young Afghans expressing their views. So I see my job as bringing people to the people, in this case we're talking Afghans, to the Afghans I meet that impress me or that mark me or I think have something good or bad to say to the rest of the world.
Let's look at Syria now, a conflict that's been going on for 6 years. How does this conflict compare to others that you have covered in the past? What is it about it that makes it worse?
In some ways, it's exactly the same, but in other ways, it's utterly, completely different. There was one time someone asked me for some pictures from Afghanistan, so I went into a cupboard and I had these photographs that photographers would come in and out in Kabul when I lived there through the winter of 89. They would leave, and this was when Afghanistan was the top story as Russian troops left. They'd leave their photographs with me, which is really quite sweet, and I'd get them mounted. So I went out and took them, and what did I have? I took out a picture of children screaming in a hospital, another picture of queues for bread, another picture of Russian soldiers parading in Kabul, another picture of President Najibullah, and then a cover of Time magazine saying Najibullah must go. And then I'm thinking, oh, what do I do in Syria? Children in hospitals, people lining up for bread, Russian soldiers helping President Assad, front cover of magazines, President Assad must go. But fast forward between Afghanistan and Syria, why it is utterly, completely different is that I think this is factually correct. This is certainly what UN envoys say. Never has there been a war where so many outside players are involved, such that the war has stopped being about Syria a long time ago. And when, on an almost weekly basis, war crimes are committed by one side or the other, we seem to be incapable of doing anything to stop the crises of our time. And some people, wise men and women of our world who occupy, senior positions in the UN say, if the world really wanted to, 192 countries plus territories, we could do something about it. We could solve the refugee crisis. We could come to an agreement. But we are so, first of all, divided in terms of backing different actors on the ground. And then, as always, in parallel with the war on the ground, there is the battle for truth. And this battle for truth is so much more ferocious now because there's a whole kind of the war on that front is so developed because now we talk about fake news, we talk about alternative facts, we now have a whole profusion of, Russian state TV, Turkish state TV, a whole myriad of private television channels. And everyone has their own version of what the capital T truth is. And they all believe it and they all can find just enough evidence just to sustain that version of the reality.
How does that affect your job? Do you feel like you are fighting against a rising tide?
I'll take Aleppo as an example. Aleppo, there was a period for months where Aleppo was never out of the headlines. It was at the top of the entree in most capitals around the world, and most of all in the region. Every day, someone was crying out for Aleppo, crying out for the hospitals, for the schools, for the children. When the battle reached its last months, and I was in Aleppo then, I went in with a government visa, so I was in West Aleppo. Crudely, the reporting from the so-called mainstream media, particularly American television channels, came down to children. That the children were being hit. Horrible photographs of children which went viral. The children are suffering in Aleppo. The Russian media were all about the terrorists which were in East Aleppo. Terrorism versus children. And the truth was somewhere in the middle. Yes, the children were getting hit because they were not just on the front line, they were the front line. They were in the hospitals and the schools which came under bombardment. But there were groups on that side. There were groups backed by the West, but there were also groups linked to Al-Qaeda, the terrorist, so-called terrorists, the Russians call them. They are sanctioned by the United Nations. So the Russians and the Iranians and the right-wing media who covered the war and accused the West of trying to make it just about children, they refused to believe that Russian and Syrian aircraft were bombing hospitals. And that. But the evidence is there. This is not just journalists. This is medical associations, United Nations investigations. They refuse to believe that there was any targeting and killing of children, of innocent people in this war. So it's somewhere in the middle, because it's not black and white. These are such complex battlefields, and the proverbial fog of war, you know, which has been around ever since there have been war reporters. The fog of war now has lightning, thunder, rain clouds, everything all at the same time. It's a perfect or imperfect storm.
And then you have an editor back in London who says, OK, Lise, 2.5 minutes on the 10 o'clock news, sum it all up.
Yes. The BBC, to its credit, is they still put in resources in, and we still, with difficulty, get visas to go to Syria. So, you know, I feel very privileged. There are times when you wish you didn't see some of the things you see in Syria, but it is a story of our time, and it is very illustrative of some of the real dilemmas of our time, and certainly the challenges of our time, and the real stains of our time. And to see it is something one would never forget it. Certainly Syrians aren't going to forget it, but it's really an important part of journalism.
When do you stop doing this sort of reporting? Do you think that there comes a moment where you think, well, look, I was in Pakistan in 1988.
Yeah, I know, it's a long time.
Are there moments where you think,
I better be a dentist?
Well, or a different sort of journalist.
Yes, I think people, I have a close friend, Lindsay Hilsum, who's the international editor for Channel 4 News. And so every 10 years we have a sit down. I said, let's go to talk. What do you think? How long do you think we can do this? And we end up talking. And by the end of the conversation, we decide that actually we have the best jobs in the world. Why wouldn't we even think about leaving? But you have to make sure you can still do it, that you have the energy to do it, and that it doesn't just become, oh, another story, that you can still see it for on its own terms, in its own time, and you can still convey the story in the way that it should be. Perhaps you take longer breaks in between stories, but I think even the BBC would want that, because if you're 2 weeks in Syria, it can be demanding. Imagine what it's like if you have to live there and you can't leave. And you find ways to do, in my case, longer documentaries, or you write, or you... So you find pauses, if you like, to lighten it up a bit. I do think about... I mean, I have colleagues who are in their 70s who are still doing it. John Simpson, our World Affairs editor, he has no intention to give it up. I don't know, maybe one day. I always believe that things will percolate on the back of your head, and someday I'll wake up and think, maybe I should just go back to Canada. For now, I'm okay. I'm still very committed to the stories I do, because they're not just stories, they're part of my life. So going to Afghanistan it's principally driven, I want to see friends there. I want to see what it's like. I want to go to places. I want to just, you know, feel the heat and the dust there. And that's not just a journalistic thing. It's not just a story that I'm going to do for the 10 o'clock news or for NewsHour on the World Service. It's part of my life. So when you say we're going to stop doing it, that means you stop being who you are and you stop living a certain kind of life. So it's not just something that you say, right, I'm retiring now. Well, then what happens to the life that you've lived? You can't stop, because people are showing up at your door. Hi, I'm here from Kabul. And we're on the email, or Facebook, Twitter. You can't get away from it all. Maybe I'll go to Mars.
Lise Doucet, thank you so much.
Thank you. Did I say too much?
The Big Interview is produced by Guy Lutz and edited by Dear Caesar. My name is Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.